majority of our clothes were soaked all the way through. Our sleeping pads were fairly wet, but not too bad. And by grace of God, our sleeping bags were dry. And so that was the biggest thing. Like, okay, we can at least, we're not going to die or anything tonight. We're not going to have anything bad happen, but it's not going to be the most comfortable. And so, yeah. And after that, it turned into, okay, well, it's too cold for our clothes to really dry out. My pants dried out the next morning when I put them on and they were still soaking wet. My body heat cooled them off, but our socks and shoes stayed wet pretty much the rest of that trip. And so that was when we were in lower elevations. When we got up into the higher elevations near Klingman's Dome, which is actually the highest point in the park, that was when, like, things that were wet before are now frozen. And so there was no drying them out.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. The episode this week is going to be a little bit different. My guest this week is Jacob Dieter. Yes, you may have noticed by the last name, we are related. Jacob is my grandson. For the past year, he has been living in different parts of the country, completing his clinical rotations as a physical therapist. He took the opportunity while he was out and about different parts of the country to hike and backpack and explore the trails all over the United States. He also took up rock climbing. And so we have conversations about his backpacking adventures and also a little bit about rock climbing. So if you're, for most of us here, I know we're runners, but this is a little bit different. I know that running is oftentimes a way that we can keep ourselves in condition to go do other things just to mix things up. Jacob is now working as a PT, so I do get to introduce him as Dr. Dieter. We had a lot of fun in this episode. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jacob Dieter. It almost feels kind of, because a lot of times, you know, when I'm interviewing, talking to people on the podcast, it's people that I don't know. I mean, sometimes I don't know them at all. I mean, the first time I've met them is, and so, you know, you and I, we've talked and you've showed us pictures of your adventures and, mm-hmm. you know, so there, I know a little bit about what you've been through. So I'm kind of like, okay, how am I going to do this? it just feels different than a regular podcast, but I'm glad that you've come on to talk to me about this. So, just for the people who don't know who you are, just give a little. Can you give a little bit of a background about, particularly your outdoor adventures and your sports stuff? Since this is, you know, we talk about running and mindset for sports, kind of give a little bit about where you've been.
So I am now a physical therapist. I've been in school for physical therapy over the last couple of years, but I just recently graduated. So I've had a lot of experience in sport and I've been involved in playing sports and then running and hiking and all that. And I really enjoy just being outdoors as much as I can. And so over the last couple of years, I've gotten much more into backpacking and camping and more of the strenuous hiking, long distance hiking over the last couple of years. So trying to go on treks where I'm out in the woods and wilderness for upwards of a week and trying to hike in terms of 20 miles a day with fully unsupported the whole time. So I've been doing that for a bit now. This last year, I did a lot of traveling. And so I was able to go to a lot of different states, a lot of different cool parks and cool parts of the country and get in a lot of hiking miles, mostly backpacking miles as well. So,
yeah. And one of the things that, that kind of caught my attention was that when you had, you'd set a goal for a number of miles to hike in 2021. So how did that come about? I mean, so you kind of went from like, oh yeah, I kind of like to hike a little bit to saying, okay, here's my goal of mileage. And that's kind of like what a lot of serious runners will do. Because at the beginning of the year, says, yeah, I want to get in certain miles. And I think you also had some certain routes that you had in mind as well.
Yeah. So it was the when was it? Winter break of 2020. So right before Christmas of 2020, my now fiance, and I went out on a backpacking trip in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And that was a 6-day, this was like our first big trip where we were multiple days. We'd done a few weekend warrior trips, nothing more than like 30 miles or so. And in the 6-day trip, we ended up hiking. It was like 104 miles or something, completely unsupported, pack in, pack out, and like some 15,500 feet of elevation gain or something like that. But we got done with it, and I was like, that was awesome. It was super fun. And it was a big experience. We had lots of things that went right, lots of things that went wrong, a few different scary nights from potentially getting hypothermia, different things that happened there. So, but afterwards I was like, that was cool. I want to do more of that. And that was a big trip in one go. What would I be able to do in a whole year potentially? And so then I was in my head trying to think through different numbers. What would that number be? This was one trip. It was 100 miles. What could I do? I like realistically over this next year, knowing that I'm still in school at that point. And I've been doing some traveling though for going on different clinical rotations for my, end of schooling. And so I was throwing out different numbers of in my head of what it might be. And I ended up coming down to the 500 mile mark. Thinking like whatever, if it's short hikes, I will count it, but trying to get on a few decent backpacking routes as well. And just, I saw that as an opportunity of a year where I'll be doing a lot of traveling and just try to get as many miles in as I can. And as many backpacking miles specifically as I'm able to. It wasn't all that, but that's what I did, as many as I could. And so I think, what did I end up with? I ended up with 516 miles total for the whole year. So
that's pretty cool. Now tell me a little bit more about your Great Smoky Mountain mountain experience, because I know you kind of glossed over the fact that hypothermia was an issue. I kind of threw that out there. It's like, oh yeah, we dealt with hypothermia.
Yeah.
So what was, I remember the pictures, but kind of describe kind of what your trek was like.
Yeah. So it was in the middle of December when we went. For some reason, the big backpacking routes that Andrea and I have gone on have been in December, because we're usually on Christmas break. It's the time when we have the most opportunity. So with that, then comes cold backpacking and cold camping. And so on this trip, the second day, it rained the entire day we were there. I mean, it was upper to mid 30s the entire day. So it was cold rain and just exhausting. And we had a lot of creek crossings that day. We counted how many creek crossings total over the entire trip. And I want to say like we had like 48 creeks that we crossed over the entire 6 days. And I want to say like 35 of them were on that one day. Most of them were just little rock skippers, or you just jump, or you go from rock to rock and walk on top of a log and hope you don't slip in. But a few of them were ones you had to wade through the water, and that water was very, very cold when it's the middle of December, and you know it's going to be 20 degrees at night when you're sleeping. And it was the very last, one of the very last creek crossings of the day. It was getting later in the day. It was one that we had to wade in, and it was about mid-thigh deep. And Andrea went first, and about 3/4 of the way, she actually slipped and fell into the creek fully, not fully submerged, but you know, for the most part submerged, and got back up and kept going. And I think we weren't wearing shoes at that point either. We were holding onto our shoes. And so that was part of the reason why she slipped. And so I was freaking out, cause I'm just watching this happen and I have to go as well afterwards. And so I'm really worried for her. And, then she gets across and she's soaking wet and cold, and now it's my turn, and I ended up actually slipping in the exact same spot as her. So I then also got submerged. Wow. And I was holding onto my shoe, and I accidentally let go of one of the shoes, and it started floating down, and I barely reached out and grabbed it, because that would have also stunk to be like, oh, I have 50 miles still with one shoe to go. Yeah. In the Smoky Mountains. But anyways, we got on shore, and at this point, we're just soaking wet. Our bags got in the water some too, so we're not really sure what's wet and what's not. We had rain covers on our bags, so hopefully things are a little bit dry, but our sleeping bags are down sleeping bags. So if those got wetted through, then we wouldn't have any insulation. It was a whole mess. And at this point, it was about 4 o'clock, 4:15-ish or so. And we were supposed to have like 2 miles left in the day still, 2 to 3 miles. And the sun's setting. Or no, it was actually closer to 4:30 to 5. So we were like, we're not going to be able to make it. So we had to cut the day early, find a random campsite and set up and like damage control and see what's wet and what's not. And so the majority of our clothes were soaked all the way through. Our sleeping pads were fairly wet, but not too bad. And by grace of God, our sleeping bags were dry. And so that was the biggest thing. We're like, okay, we can at least, we're not going to die or anything tonight. We're not going to have anything bad happen, but it's not going to be the most comfortable. And so, yeah. And after that, it turned into, okay, well, it's too cold for our clothes to really dry out. My pants dried out the next morning when I put them on and they were still soaking wet. My body heat cooled them off, but our socks and shoes stayed wet pretty much the rest of that trip. And so that was when we were in lower elevations. When we got up into the higher elevations near Klingman's Dome, which is actually the highest point in the park, that was when, like, things that were wet before are now frozen. And so there was no drying them out. So we got to the point where we had our shoes were wet. So every morning they were frozen shoes. So we're putting on ice cubes of shoes first thing in the morning. And then you had to make a decision with your wet socks. Okay, do I want to put frozen socks on or cold wet socks on in the morning? So we both decided cold wet socks are going to be better than frozen socks. So we put them in a bag and put those in the bottom of our sleeping bag while we're sleeping to keep them from freezing overnight. So It was a fun adventure. We both had lots of things that we had never anticipated happen, such as falling in a creek or not realizing how wet things are going to get. And then when they get wet, what do you do to try to dry them out when it's 20 degrees at night? Yeah, that was fun. And so it was also a challenge too, of like figuring out how can we get miles in and be comfortable and push ourselves farther and try to go more miles out in the backcountry.
Yeah. And you were, you said 100 and some miles in 6 days. So that's, I was trying to figure out the mileage. It's about 18 miles a day or so.
Approximately. Yeah. Most days were about 17 miles a day. Our longest day was we had 2 days that were over 20 miles. One of them was like 20.2 or something like that. And the other one was a 24 mile day. So we had a couple shorter days and a couple longer days.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then you set the goal to hike even more.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that was fun. Let's just see how much more I can do.
Well, and then you traveled to quite a few different places with your clinical rotation. Mm-hmm. So where were some of the places you got to hike during the year?
So the places that I had clinical rotations for school, I was in Colorado for a month. And then I was down in St. Louis for a month. And then I had another one in Illinois. So there wasn't a ton I did there. And then I was out in Atlanta, Georgia for 2.5 months as well. So that was most of the places I went for school. And then I did some other traveling here just for fun on my own as well. So the total breakdown, it was 12 states was what ended up everywhere I hiked over the course of the year, including like Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, like places close to me, but then as far out as I was out in California on a trip, and then out in Georgia and Colorado and different places like that. So,
yeah. And you went to Yosemite for, mm-hmm. For a while too.
Yeah. So Andrea, and myself went on a backpacking trip in Yosemite, with her parents, actually. So we were in the backcountry for 5 days there. And then we also hit Sequoia National Park as well while we were out there for little day hikes. But we did a backpacking route out in Yosemite, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, cool. And so I know you'd hiked quite a bit of the Appalachian Trail. You'd set kind of a sub-goal for that, if I remember.
Yeah, I did as well. So because I was in Georgia, the Appalachian Trail starts in Georgia, I decided, okay, let's just see how long the Georgia section of the AT is. And so it ended up being somewhere around like 70 or 80 miles or something like that. I was like, I can do that. It's not a big deal. And so I told myself, I'm there for 2.5 months. Let's just hike the entire Georgia section of the Appalachian Trail. And I mean, that should be plenty. I shouldn't take too long. And My original goal was to try to do it in like 3 or 4 weekends, because I would just get shuttles from one end to the other and hike from one end to the other and where my just have my car be there already. But it turns out that that was more money than I was wanting to spend on having someone shuttle me from my car to a starting point so I can hike back to my car. So I did the majority of it as an out and back style. So I'd park my car, hike out, camp, and then hike back the next day. Or most days were a 3-day weekend. So I'd after work on Friday, hit the trailhead, go hike for a couple hours, set up camp, hike all day Saturday, and then majority of the day on Sunday, or a portion of the day on Sunday, back to my car. So I'd end up covering it twice. So I ended up doing the entire Georgia section twice because of that. So
I didn't realize that. Is that something on the Appalachian Trail that the shuttles is that like private individuals who like you can hire, or is
yeah. It so it's kind of like a little like a microeconomy there in the Appalachian Trail like community. Lots and lots of different shuttle services of just people who offer a shuttle. So I ended up actually doing a shuttle one time. So it was on my very last section of it that I had left to go. It was like a 30-mile section or 30-mile section. And so I wasn't able to do that in one weekend for a out and back, because I would be like doing 60 miles starting Saturday and through Sunday. Or Friday night and back on Sunday and be back at work. It would just be a little bit more than I was wanting to do for a 2-day weekend. So, yeah, otherwise it's like Facebook groups. You find a shuttle driver and you just shoot them a text, be like, hey, I want to do this section to that, this point to that point. Can you give me a shuttle ride from Woody Gap to Amicalula Falls, on this day? And they're either like, yeah, sure, I'll pick you up this time. Or they're like, I'm busy, text so-and-so, and then they would give you a number. And so there was a couple weekends where I was like, I'm trying to find a shuttle this week. And that was the one that I was actually trying to find a shuttle for. I was like, I'm not going to be able to find a shuttle. I'm going to have to break this into 2 different weekends. And because I texted someone and then he's, I'm full, I can't have any room, text so-and-so. And I had texted like 5 or 6 different shuttle drivers and everybody was full. And one of them eventually was just like, really, like after he said, let me know if you ever end up getting a ride. And so he ended up squeezing me into his schedule sometimes. So It was pretty wild.
So like they have a network of people who do this, and they can refer to each other.
Wild too. The guy I ended up getting a shuttle from, it was Ron's Appalachian Trail Shuttle Service. Great guy. Would definitely recommend to anybody trying to do or needing a shuttle for the Appalachian Trail. But he was saying that, I mean, he needs an oil change like every 5 days because he drives 400 to 500 miles a day.
Wow.
Just shuttles. Anywhere in the Georgia or North Carolina section, he offers shuttle rides.
So is that like his full-time job?
Yeah, I mean, that's full-time.
What's that? It is full-time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, you couldn't do anything else if you're driving 400 miles a day.
Not really.
I did not even know that about the
Yeah, his car was over 500,000 miles on it.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So, so anybody who's looking to do that, is that like on the entire Appalachian Trail? Is it go all the whole length of it? You can find.
Yeah, people? For the most part. So I ended up joining a couple other Facebook groups just so because I was section hiking it. And not through hiking the entire thing. I joined a couple AT section hike Facebook groups. And so there's lots of people saying like, hey, I'm looking for like who are good shuttle drivers for the New York section or for whatever section in whatever state. And then people comment and then send it on out through there. The most common areas are definitely up in Maine and up and down in Georgia, because usually those are the 2 starting points, whether you're going Sobo or Nobo. And so because of that, like there's a lot more shuttle drivers in those areas, but you can find shuttle drivers pretty much along the entire thing.
Wow. That's I hadn't even thought anything I'd even considered. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was so much of a self-sufficient, you know, I would have probably just like driven to the trailhead and done an out and back and never known any difference.
Yeah, and that is what I did most of the time. But it's nice when you're trying to cover more miles on the trail itself. So there's two different ways of like looking at it. Is are you trying to get miles to get miles, or are you trying to cover more of this specific trail? And so like if I really wanted to do more of the miles, I would have done, or more miles on the AT, I would have done more shuttles so I can cover 30 to 35 miles in one weekend on the trail and then not have to backtrack it again.
Right. Right.
So I could chunk it more and do more of the Appalachian Trail that way. It just costs more because you have to pay for shuttles more then.
Yeah. So what's the Appalachian Trail like? I mean, I've heard about it and talked to some people who've run it and, you know, done some things on that. But well, what was your impression of the Appalachian Trail?
It was fun. It's very hilly. It's not like it doesn't feel as mountainy as like the Rocky Mountains do, just because there's not the prominent peaks or anything like that. It's deemed, I've heard one of the things is deemed as the green tunnel, and I definitely would say that holds true. There's several times when you are in like a tunnel, that's just, there's a trail and you have a canopy over top of you that's probably a couple feet above your head, and you see trees and that's about all you see. It's trees and trail. But it's every now and then, the time that I was in, it was beautiful because it was all in fall. I did it in, primarily in October and November. So leaves were prime autumn color, so it was gorgeous the entire time that I was doing it. It's strenuous. It's very, very strenuous because there's lots of what are deemed PUDs, P-U-Ds, pointless ups and downs.
Pointless? I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's just you go up this mountain and down the mountain, and up the mountain and down the mountain. There's not, it's not like you get to the top of a mountain and you're like, oh, cool, I'm at Round Top Mountain. There's nothing to see still. It's just trees because everything's in tree line still. You're like, all right, time to go down. I worked really hard to get up here because you've got 1,000-foot gain over the next mile. Okay, let's just haul up this mile and all right, cool, I'm here. Keep going. There's nothing to see. Just move on.
1,000-foot gain in a mile?
Mm-hmm.
Were there switchbacks or does it go straight up?
That's the other thing. They do not believe in switchbacks out east. So that's the other primary difference between like eastern like Appalachian mountains versus like the Rocky Mountains is there's really not switchbacks, which is what makes it so difficult despite it being such low elevation. Because I think the highest elevation I got was maybe, I don't even think it was 5,000 feet, maybe like 4,300 feet in elevation, which isn't much. I mean, it was still 1,000-foot gains, but the worst part about it is it's just 1,000 feet straight uphill. And it's stairs that are like knee-high stairs the whole way a lot of times too.
Yeah, I've heard that from some other people who've been on it. And so it amazes me the people who then have gone for fastest known time for the entire Appalachian Trail. Mm-hmm. You know, they're actually, you know, trying to run parts of that.
It makes you really respect those who will through hike the entire thing for one. I met a few people who were doing that, and that was really, really cool. The community on the Appalachian Trail is really, really neat. But like, you respect those who do the entire thing, and then you respect even more so the people who are speed running it.
Yeah. Did you see anybody who was speed running?
I did not know, but I was also pretty late in the year. So most of the time, anybody who would have been speed running, it would have been a little bit, or would have already been done, or would have started much earlier than where I was at. So.
Yeah. So have you ever considered what they call fast packing? Have you done any of that?
I don't know right now if I would consider it at this moment, just because I take a lot of time to take a lot of pictures. And so okay. I think that's the biggest thing for me right now is I like to go out into the woods and just like be out there and be off the grid and take pictures and enjoy that stuff. But I definitely, when I'm doing it by myself, I consider fast packing a lot more because I like getting in the miles. But if I'm going like with Andrea or anybody else, I like to try to just enjoy the time and do it at whatever pace anybody else is going at. So,
right. So what is your kind of your normal pace if you're by yourself?
If I'm by myself, if I can maintain around like, it sounds slow, but it's like 3 to 3.5 miles an hour. Is usually a pretty decent pace for me to be consistently going for hours on end, mm-hmm. Pretty much the entire day. And that's the only reason why it is. That's with a full pack. If I'm going with a day pack or no pack, then it's much faster. I don't know what my actual pace is at that point, but I know if I have a full pack with all the things that I need for food, water, like sleeping, shelter, all that stuff, which is probably comes out to, I want to say I have a heavier pack right now just because I have a little bit, not always all the nicest gear, but I also have some like luxury gear items too. Mine's probably in like the 25 to 30 pound range, with probably closer to 20 to 25 pounds base weight. So then whatever food and water on top of that.
Okay. So what's the food and water run?
Like weight wise?
Weight wise. Yeah.
I mean, it probably gets up to like 30 to 35 pounds, okay, depending on how long I'm going for. If it's just a weekend, it's probably close to like 28 to 30 pounds. But if I'm going for a full week, I can probably push upwards of 35 pounds.
Well, that's actually not too bad a weight. I mean, for, you know, cause I know, you know, just trying to think the times that I've done, you know, a few backpacking trips I used to do, a lot of times the weight on my pack would get up closer to 40 or 50. And, mm-hmm. that's a lot of weight to carry.
Yeah. And the biggest thing too is like, if I'm going by myself, I was hammock camping the entire time. My hammock weighs a little bit more than like where I could have saved weight. And so that's little things here and there. That's like, I mean, ounces add up. And if I cut a few ounces down, then maybe I'm going upwards of 3.5 to 4 miles an hour now. And that's an extra mile I can get in and that kind of thing. So, and most of the time I'm hiking from sun up to sundown and then just having a quick lunch in the middle.
Uh-huh. Hammock camping, do you carry a tent?
If I'm going with Andrea, yeah, we have a backpacking tent it's a 3-person tent though. So, I mean, it's only 4 pounds. And we end up splitting the weight between the two of us. So I'll carry like the body and the rain fly, and she'll carry like the poles and stakes. So that splits the weight up, mm-hmm. which is fine. But if I'm just camping by myself, a 3-person tent is just bigger than what I need. And so I don't necessarily need to carry that full 4 pounds. And so, I mean, I think not like my hammock is a lot lighter than 4 pounds, but it's just more comfortable and easy for me to sleep in by myself. So,
yeah. Yeah. I've looked at hammocks and I've seen the hammock camping and I'm like, you know, that's one of those things. I haven't backpacked for a long time. And so, you know, hearing your stories is kind of intrigued me. I was like, yeah. And then I hear, you know, of runners who fast pack and I know, you know, fast packing is kind of a catch all term. But you know, usually it's, they're going a little bit faster than on a normal walk. Mm-hmm. But they still, I mean, it's some of them have the goal to go, you know, see how far they can get each day, but some of them just, you know, do the sections so they can stop and enjoy the view as well. Mm-hmm. And, so they can actually get farther to see more stuff than you could just walking alone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a whole range of, people's preferences for that.
Yeah.
I know that you just got back where your latest one was, you did a rim to rim to rim in the Grand Canyon. So
yeah.
how was that when that was still, in 2021, was still part of your total mileage?
So that was actually the trip that got me over the 500 mile mark, was the Grand Canyon trip. So we got a little bonus hike in on that trip. So we drove out to the Grand Canyon from Iowa. So that was a 23.5-hour drive or something like that. But on that drive, we drove through Utah. So we got to stop in Arches National Park and do a little day hike there, which was really nice. But otherwise, the rim to rim to rim hike was probably one of the smoothest backpacking trips that we've ever actually gone on. Nothing was lost, like nothing was forgotten. It was actually not too strenuous comparison wise. It was super nice weather because we went there in the middle of December. It wasn't too hot. Nights it didn't get lower than I think 25 degrees, which is super comfortable to sleep in and camping wise. It was really fun. There wasn't too much snow or ice, which was nice. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Well, that's interesting you say it was not as strenuous as others that you've been on, because I know a lot of people kind of look at that as like, well, that's a very strenuous thing to do.
It was, I don't know, for some reason it just felt it felt easier. And maybe it was also the fact that I had been hiking on the Appalachian Trail for the last 2.5 months. every single weekend on out, I was.
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah, going straight up and down the mountains out there would build up your muscles.
Yeah. And so like the first day we hiked from the South Rim to, what was the name of the campground? Cottonwood, campground. And so that was like a 14-mile day, but the first 7 miles was all downhill. 'Cause like 6,500 feet of an elevation loss down into the bottom of the canyon. And then we just had like a 1,500 foot gain over the next 7 miles. So like that felt super easy comparison wise to everything else going on. And then from there, we had another 14-mile day where we went from Cottonwood up to the North Rim and then right back down to Cottonwood. And so we ended up actually being, because we went, did like a base camp wise, we were able to do that one with the day pack. So, I mean, yeah, we had a 6,500 foot, 5,000 foot gain over the next 7 miles or whatever it was, but it wasn't terribly hard because we didn't have as heavy of packs. And the ice and snow wasn't too much at the North Rim, which was really nice. So we didn't have to put on micro spikes or anything. So, and then the next day was smooth sailing. We just went back to Phantom Ranch. So we kind of woke up late, or we slept in. We went and checked out this waterfall off on a side trail, which was really cool because it was a waterfall you could like get it behind. And then it was really nice weather. And then the last day we went out on a different trail than we came in. So we went down on the South Kaibab Trail. We went up on the Bright Angel Trail. So South Kaibab is about a 7 mile trail for that 6,500 feet of loss. And then Bright Angel is about a 9 mile trail for that 6,500 feet that you have to then go back up. So kind of spread it out a little bit more. And that one was full packed, but we were just feeling really good too. And that kind of helped. So.
That's cool. And I also know that you have kind of, decided that you're going to take up another sport of climbing.
Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of rock climbing as well. So because I was traveling so much on my clinical experience, it came out to about 6.5 to 7.5 months total I was on the road by myself and just staying in different states and cities. And I don't know a lot of people in most of them. And so I was just like, well, let's figure out something to do. And I had a buddy of mine take me rock climbing at a climbing gym before, and it was super fun. So I just found climbing gyms nearby. And so most of the week I'd go to work to do my clinical work there. And then right after there, I'd drive to the gym and I'd rock climb for about 2 or 3 hours and then go home and make food and sleep. And then on the weekends, I would go backpacking on wherever I could find routes. So it was a lot of climbing. I did mostly gym stuff. I did get to go outdoor climbing some in Tennessee, near Chattanooga, Tennessee. So that was really fun. I've gotten my own rope, and I'm going to be doing a lot more of that this year as well. So,
on outdoor climbing.
Yeah.
Okay. So what? So I was going to ask you. I'll ask you about gear, rock climbing gear, and then come back to some of your backpacking stuff. Mm-hmm. But so what do you have to do for rock climbing? Because I know there are some ultra runners out there who are doing both. In fact, I heard about one lady that she did an ultra and a climb in the same day. And there's, I don't know that it was an official event, but I know that there are, you know, people who are out there doing both, ultra marathons and rock climbing. So what kind of gear do you need to,
rock climbing, like for the most part, if you're just doing gym stuff, you can get away with just a pair of shoes and a harness. Mm-hmm. excuse me. Most gyms have their own ropes that you can top rope with, which is where the rope is anchored at the top already. And so you just need, you clip in and then your belayer clips in and the rope's already hooked up to the top and you just go from there. You need a belay device as well, technically. I just bought, if you want to do anything outdoors, you need a rope to climb with, and it has to be like a specific climbing rope. You need your harness, your shoes, your belay device, a helmet is nice to have. And then you need a bunch of gear for making anchors and for clipping in if you're doing any sort of what's called lead climbing. So top roping is when you have the rope at the top and you climb up and it's anchored before you start the climb. Lead climb is when you have the rope attached to you, and as you climb, you clip into carabiners. And if you're doing outdoors, you have to put the carabiner in as well. And you clip in, and so then you have like a temporary anchor. If you were to fall, that would catch you. And then you build an anchor at the top once you get to the top.
Yeah, I've seen outdoor climbers. That's my vision, is the climbers who, you know, have these you know, like whole bunch of like the stuff hanging off their waist. Yeah. And I'm looking, and it just, I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff that's there. And I look at that going like, and I know that each one has to be, you have different things. Like, so what kind of it's almost like a science to know what to use where and
yeah. There's a different type of climbing as well. Even on top of lead climbing. So when you're just lead climbing, there's usually bolts in the rock already.
So it's a preset course and you can just clip in. And
usually if you're doing lead climbing, yeah. So you have what are called quick draws, which is a carabiner, a little strap, and then another carabiner. And so you clip one carabiner into the bolt, and then you clip your rope into the other end of the other carabiner there. If that's for a bolted route, a preset route that's already been put up by somebody else. And so that's the most common kind of type of sport climbing. That's usually how you can climb the hardest grades, the most difficult grades of climbing that way. But more like adventure climbing is what's called trad climbing. And that's when a lot more of like the intricate pieces of gear come in. And so there's like gear pieces called nuts, which is literally a little wire with a metal bolt, like bolt almost on it, that you find a crack to slide it in, pull on it to make sure it'll hold if it were to be fall on. There's cams, which are like trying to think of how to describe a cam. It's basically like a spring-loaded piece of gear that when you compress it, you can put it into a crack. And then when you let go, it expands into that crack. And that would then hold your weight if you were to fall on it. And so then that comes into a trad route, which doesn't have any gear on it, that you have to then place your own gear to protect yourself in case of a fall. And so that, then there's a lot more science, and I'm well behind that. I don't know how to do that stuff quite yet. That's also the trad sets are so much more expensive too. So that'll take a bit before I get into doing trad climbing.
And the thing I was always wondering about is, do you have to buy new like pieces of equipment for each time you go up? I mean, do they take them back out of the rocks as you go along?
Usually, yeah. So usually what happens this is like another goal that I have down the line too, would be to do what's considered a big wall. So I don't know what's actually the official height for a big wall, but climbing some wall that's at least 1,000 feet taller or more. Is what I'd like to try to do. But you have a partner with you. And so if you are doing trad or you're doing sport climbing and you have carabiners or cams or nuts or anything like that in the wall, you climb up, you set all your gear, you get to the top, you build your anchor, you clip into the anchor, and then the person who was belaying you, then it's their turn to climb up. And so then you belay them from the top. And as they climb up, they clean the route. So then they take your pieces of gear off, put them on their harness, and clean it as they go up. So then technically you don't leave any gear on the actual wall.
Okay. So you don't come back down the wall, then you find another route down?
If it's a big wall, yeah. Usually you go up and then you hike down. Depending on it, you can rappel back down though too. And so you get up, you set your anchor, and then as you're rappelling down, you can clean stuff. And if it's what's called multi-pitch route, which is usually a pitch is somewhere between like 50 and 60 meters per pitch. Mm-hmm. And so if you chunk up the wall that way, so you might have to rappel down one pitch, get your gear, and then rappel down another one. And you just do a series of different rappels down different pitches till you get all the way back down.
Okay. But In the top, do you have to leave your top point? Do you have to leave it there?
Yeah. So either usually if you're doing top rope climbing, that's usually like the more beginner friendly, the less adventurous kind. You either hike to the top and you can set an anchor at the top, so by getting up to there, or because they're usually on bolted routes, there's a top rope, there's an anchor at the top that's bolted. So you can lead climb up, set your bolt, then have your top rope, and you can top rope it up and down however many times you want. And then on the last time, you would then clean it. So you'd climb up to the top, clip yourself into the anchor, take your gear off of it, feed the rope through the permanent anchor that's on there. Because usually you have your rope through your own gear, so you'll have your own wear and tear. You don't do it on the public stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the last one, when you do put it through that last one, that does stay there. And then you rappel down and okay. You have all of your personal gear, but the bolted stuff stays up there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Cause I know, I did a little bit of rappelling and I think you guys, you were with us too. And we always had to climb back up and untie the rope off the tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're doing something like where you're anchoring on a tree or something like that, then yeah, you usually have to hike back up to the top
and yeah.
take it off.
I'll be back to my conversation with Jacob in a minute, but first I would like to talk to you a little bit about running. If you're a regular listener here, you know we usually are talking about the process of running, and if you're a runner, you know that most of us who are runners, face rather common running injuries. Plantar fasciitis, runner's knee, IT band issues, Achilles tendonitis, shin splints, stress fractures, and those are just the top six. There's a lot of ways that runners tend to injure their bodies from the stress of running. Traditional remedy is find the right shoe. In fact, shoe companies have made a fortune on selling you the right shoes. Coaches will also say strength training can help reduce your chances. I found an alternative. It is called Qi running. That's Qi, C-H-I, running. Qi running is based on the martial art Tai Chi, where the body moves in a natural order. The big muscles do the heavy lifting, the smaller muscles do less, the tiniest muscles do very little. This is counter to the way most people run, which is using the small muscles of your legs to push yourselves forward, and you ignore the abundance of power that you have at your core. As a certified Qi running instructor, I can help you run more efficiently and with less injuries. Contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. I'd be glad to give you more information how you can run easier and more efficiently with less chance of injuries. Now, back to my conversation with Jacob Dieter. So go back to backpacking. What's your gear setup and what's kind of your idea for the gear that you use?
So for like, there's usually the big three is a shelter, a backpack, and a sleep system. For my backpack, I just have a Gregory pack. So I have a 55 liter pack, that I usually take out with me anytime I'm going on a backpacking trip. Nothing too crazy about it. I mean, it has more pockets and stuff, so I would not consider it an ultralight backpack by any means. But I mean, it's nice. It gets the job done, and it's relatively light enough for me, and it carries everything very well, so I don't feel the weight quite as much. For shelter wise, I usually have one of two shelters. I either have a hammock if I'm going by myself, or on a place with a lot of trees and not a lot of campgrounds, so I just do hammock camping, or I will have a three-person tent that I will split the weight with somebody if I'm having more than one person or tent camping. And so that one is the tent is a Nemo brand tent that I have. And then the sleep system that I have is mummy style sleeping bag that's a 15 degree rated bag, down sleeping bag that I got on Amazon when I first started getting into backpacking just to try it out, and it's lasted me this long. And then I have an inflatable air mattress that I take out with me. So it's 3.5 inches thick. It's like 20 inches wide and 72 inches long, and it inflates up. It's an insulated bag or insulated pad. And then I also bring a little inflatable pillow with me too. So those are like the big three things that like always will be with me no matter what. After that, like semantics can come into. I usually also have a cook system with me as well. That's the other thing. It's usually pretty consistent. So I have a little backpacking stove, a pot, and then fuel and whatever else I want. I also have like a backpacking coffee drip filter that I'll bring so I can have coffee out there in the backcountry. And then I have a spork knife or a long handled spoon that I can use to eat stuff with too. So, I always have a water filter on me. I always have usually two forms of a water filter. So I have one that's like a squeeze filter that I can screw onto the top of a smart water bottle. But then in case that were to break or freeze overnight, then I have like filtration tablets too that I bring with me. And then after that, those are like the essential pieces of gear. After that, it's like, well, whatever kind of thing, if I want water bottles or if I want a bladder, water bladder for drinking water. If I want to do what kinds of equipment I need for the actual trip, if it's icy and snowy, maybe I'll need micro spikes or snowshoes even. If it's a longer trip or it's a little more hilly, I might bring trekking poles. I've enjoyed using trekking poles on some of the longer hikes just because I can squeeze in a few more miles comfortably. I don't always make a fire. It just kind of depends. It's more often than not, I don't make a fire. I just hike until it gets really dark, and then I eat food and go to sleep because I'm tired. I don't want to spend time making a fire. So, those are the main pieces of gear. I also, because I really enjoy taking photography, I always bring, I have my phone, and then I always bring a battery pack with my phone, which also helps with navigating and stuff. But I also have a little mini tripod that I bring with me as well, so I can set it up for taking pictures of Andrea and I, whatever we need to do to be able to capture all the different things that we do all out there. So
what is your fuel? Food. How do you manage that?
So it's an isobutane mixture. So it's a compressed fuel system that's it's not propane. It's like a mixture of the two that then allows it to be screwed onto specific backpacking stoves. Then yeah. That help to.
What did you eat?
Oh, what did I eat? mostly
fueling for your body.
Fueling for my body. I thought you were talking about the actual fuel. The food that we eat is mostly stuff that's like freeze-dried food a lot of times, but not truly freeze-dried foods. We don't like to do the backpacker go-to meals because they're kind of not the best tasting. They don't digest the best. So usually we do a lot of ramen because it's easy. A lot of instant mashed potatoes. Stuffing is really stovetop stuffing is really common. Tuna packets, the little individual flavored tuna packets are really easy out in the backcountry. Anything that you can put on a tortilla works really well. quinoa or couscous, more so couscous, I should say, is really, really easy to make out in the backcountry. We'll do pad thai a lot is another really common one. Breakfast-wise, it's usually oatmeal or grits and creamy grits and bacon. I'll have coffee out there. Those are the most common ones. It just depends on how fancy you want to get with the backpacking meal. You can do the really easy, I'm going to do ramen, I'm going to put tuna in it, and that's all I'm going to do. Do Thanksgiving on the trail with mashed potatoes and stuffing, lots of that kind of stuff. So we like to try to make our own food as much as we can, just so we know what we're putting in our bodies. We're not just getting the pre-made frozen freeze-dried meals that also are really expensive to get. So.
Yeah. So how many calories you figure a day?
If I'm going on a longer trip, I try to put around, if we can get around the 3,500 to 4,000 calorie mark, that's usually pretty good. It's tougher to do than you'd think, but just because everything you carry has weight. And so the more food you carry, then the more it weighs and the more calories you burn to then carry that food. So it's kind of like a give and take. So I haven't had any trips that are significantly long to really push that whole, how am I needing to maintain my weight while out there? For the most part, the nutrition doesn't matter too much. Getting electrolytes in is really helpful and some form of protein. But then otherwise, you usually carbohydrate up a ton because you're going to burn it all anyway. So, usually it's around 3,000 to 3,500 calories.
What do you have, for your plans for next going forward?
I mean, for this next year, I don't have a ton of like trips planned. I just got a job here in the Quad Cities in Iowa. Andrea still has this year of schooling left to do, and we are also in the midst of planning a wedding. So we're not having as many big backpacking trips this year planned. I have a few routes picked out in Colorado that I want to do a couple weekends. And we're hoping to maybe try to do Capitol Peak in Colorado, which is like, I believe it's in the top 5 most dangerous 14ers out there. So hoping to be able to hike that one if we can. Anytime I can get out into the mountains is ideal for me. So, but yeah, and then I'm going to do as much rock climbing outdoors as well, trying to get into that a lot more this year too. So, Yeah.
That's cool. So, West Coast more than East Coast is kind of your...
I am a Rocky Mountains guy, I will have to say. I really enjoyed the autumn colors out on the East Coast in the Appalachian Mountains, but I'm a fan of the high altitude peaks, the above tree line stuff. It's really cool and really satisfying for me. So I would say Yosemite was probably the coolest like place that I went all of last year. But yeah.
So looking on farther than next year, you have a bucket list hike
the year. So one of the big bucket list hikes that Andrew and I have is we want to do the John Muir Trail. That'll probably be within the next, I don't know, 3 or 4 years that we'll probably try to hike that one. What we're going to planning on doing, so after she graduates, we're actually planning on doing travel therapy for a few years. So we're going to be moving into an RV and traveling around, probably mostly out west, for a few years, working different travel jobs and then hiking and exploring areas around. So somewhere in the midst of that, we'll hopefully hike the John Muir Trail, do a ton of backpacking and hiking in the meantime, mountain biking, rock climbing, anything else that we can do to explore different areas. We're hoping to do some rotations in Hawaii and some rotations in Alaska. So doing as much as we can to explore areas.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the John Muir Trail is a pretty popular one. I know I've talked to some people who have, or I've heard some people who have done some fast packing on that. And
yeah.
And
it would definitely be our longest trip, but I mean, it would probably be over the course of like 2 or 3 weeks. So we wouldn't have to fast pack it and just enjoy the time there.
Yeah, it's one to take your time on, because I've heard it's a really beautiful, really beautiful area.
The High Sierras are a gorgeous place. And it starts at Mount Whitney, which is also on my bucket list, which is the tallest mountain in the lower 48.
Right.
And then it ends in Yosemite, which is just an absolutely gorgeous place.
Mount Whitney is a wilderness area, if I remember right.
Count 1 second. Is it okay if I step away real quick?
Sure.
Yeah. I'm moving locations. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. Sorry about that. We're all good.
That's cool.
So, So Mount Whitney is what? It's in Sequoia National Forest.
Okay.
So that'll be, it basically goes from Sequoia National Forest through, I don't believe it goes through Sequoia National Park at all. It does mostly go through Kings Canyon National Park. And then up and finishes in Yosemite. So,
That's cool. That's cool. So, and there will be, if you get to go to Hawaii, there's hiking, a lot of trails there too. So, in Hawaii, do you have any in particular that you're looking at?
We have nothing in particular picked out there right now. We're hoping to get out there because if we do a travel contract out there, we'll be able to stay there for about three and a half months.
Okay.
So we get a lot of time then to island hop and explore and just kind of hang out there.
Yeah, I know Kauai has one of the trails that's the top 10 most dangerous in the world.
Yeah, we've found to gather towards those for some reason. We were able to hike Half Dome this last year, which I think is also in like one of the top 10 most dangerous ones technically. I don't know for sure on that, but it is one of the more treacherous ones just based on the fact that the cable section itself is so high up there with such a steep altitude or mm-hmm. steep incline.
Yeah, Brenda and I got to go on, Kalaalua Trail, if I remember right, is the name of it. And it was pretty rough. And we didn't get to, you can't go through the entire trail. You have to, for a day hike, you can only go, I think, 2 miles in. Mm-hmm. And then you have to turn around. And the entire trail is 11 miles. But it goes along the Nepali coast, and there's one section where it's only like a foot wide on the cliff, on the side of a cliff. And so
that's awesome. Yeah.
That's what makes it dangerous.
those are the types of trails that are just fun to do. There's that part of the reason why we want to do Capitol Peak this next year is just because there's near the top, one of the finishing sections is a knife's edge. So it's the tip is either side like that, and you're shimmying across the 50-foot section with just sheer drop-offs on either side. So just little things like that, they're cool because not a lot of people get out to do those things. Typically with a lot of those things, there come really, really gorgeous views, and you can really appreciate nature, and I don't know, it's just fun. And it's not necessarily like a fun to push the edge to see how dangerous it can get, it's just getting to places that not many people go to.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, that's a lot of, the appeal is, you get somewhere and there's nobody else around and you feel like you're the only person. You know, it feels very, it's a very personal experience to be in those places.
Yeah.
And to know that there's just, you know, not a crowd and there's not, and for a reason, there's a lot of people who won't go and do that.
Yeah. And then the nice part too, is the people who do, like if you do see them, it's a really, it's a fun community. The backpacking community in general it's a very friendly community. There's definitely a few who are not necessarily as friendly as others, but for the most part, it's everybody's willing to share things if they need. I mean, I've gotten there when I was out on the Appalachian Trail, I ended up hanging out with these two guys from Florida that I met at the near the campsite that I was staying at, and we hung out all night, and they had a bag of wine that they brought out, and so we were drinking wine and cooking food together, and it's just a really tight-knit community of I got your back, you got my back, and it's really fun.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. So, well, thank you a lot, Jacob. I appreciate you spending time and talking to us about your adventures.
Yeah, of course. It's my pleasure. I will continue to be going on as many adventures and as I can and keep on making those crazy
memories. So if somebody wanted to follow along, how's the best way to get in touch with you?
I usually post my stuff on Instagram. Is my primary way, I believe. My Instagram handle is @jacob.dieter. That's the primary way that I share stuff on most of my adventures and that kind of stuff. I also have them on Facebook, but yeah, I would say Instagram is the main way of contact.
Yeah, and before you go, I have a something I've started called the Bridge Questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
The workout that you like doing the least.
That I like doing the least?
Yeah, the workouts like that you would be like most willing to say, no, let's not do that one today.
I would say anytime like rear foot elevated split squat or like a Bulgarian squat style thing is in it, I'm not a huge fan of those, mainly because of how sore I get afterwards. But that's about it. I mean, everything else, long distance runs are really fun. If I'm out of shape, if I'm not in a long distance running shape, then long distance running is probably my least favorite. Because okay. I have gotten in, like, I mean, I've ran long distance stuff, not necessarily ultra marathon, but I've done marathon style training stuff. And that's fine when you're in shape. But if I have to go run an 18 mile run tomorrow, I would not enjoy that.
Okay. That's good. Okay. Second question. Weirdest thing that you've seen out on the trail.
The weirdest thing that I've seen out on the trail. It was probably the weirdest, but also the wildest thing. I actually found an airplane wreckage while out on the trail.
Where?
That was in it was in Georgia, actually. It was on a little off trail that I found. I went on to go to this this cliffside, and right next to the cliffside, there was a bunch of just wreckage of an airplane, like shrapnel. I don't know when it was there. I mean, there's nothing. It was from a long time ago, my guess. But yeah, there's a bunch of wreckage from an airplane that was.
And I've never thought of it. But, you know, you wouldn't necessarily. I mean. Who'd be responsible for picking up all those pieces and carrying it out of there?
I'm sure most of them have been like buried since then because it looked like it was an old plane. But yeah, that was probably the weirdest and wildest thing that I've seen out on the trail.
Wow, cool. That's cool. Okay, the third question, a word or phrase that sums up your life philosophy.
So this is actually... I found this on the trail as well in one of the journals that I really liked, and I try to live by it as much as I can, but it's a saying that goes something along the lines of, it does not matter how hard a step is to take, because after you take it, it is now behind you, and you've already taken it.
That's cool. I like that. I like that. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was fun to kind of just talk about all the fun stuff that I get to do on the trail.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. As a reminder, the mid-roll promotion about Chi Running, if you heard that, and don't forget to contact me here at ultramindsetpodcast.run. There you can also find the show notes and links for this episode and all the other episodes. There's a place there you can leave comments, questions, and stories, either with text or leave. We can hear your voice. If you got a great story to share, I will put it in kind of at the end here as a bonus for that particular episode. If you did enjoy this episode and you know somebody who might like it too, take a minute and share it with them. I would appreciate that. It's how I help grow the podcast, is by people who enjoy it sharing it with others. Remember, an ultramarathon mindset is not just about running. I'm a life coach, ultramarathon mindset coach, and I want to help you go after your epic thing. And we talk a little bit about that here. Having something epic that you want to go after, and if you feel stuck in that, contact me here at ultramindsetpodcast.run. Leave me a voice message or text. You can also hit me up on Instagram. It's at Eric Dieter. And I'm most active there on Instagram. Thanks again for listening. I will see you next time.